This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode, Shifting Gears. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. All of the negatives that are associated with cars, the congestion, the pollution, noise, they feel more noticeable and grating in cities. Car exhaust has been linked to childhood asthma. Many researchers have pointed to cars as a culprit in rising obesity rates. The asphalt of streets and parking lots creates rainwater runoff. Still, cars have been king of the road for decades, but there is some pushback. Jad Slayman has more.
Kids skate around, dart back and forth, playing tag and soccer. They scream for no apparent reason. It feels like a playground at recess, but it's a city street, 78th Street to be exact, in Jackson Heights, New York City. Almost a whole block of it has been closed to car traffic since 2011. 8-year-old Alexandria and her friends pass around a volleyball. This is her favorite part of the neighborhood.
Because, like, it's large. And also, like, I get to have space to play soccer and other different sports.
Jackson Heights is a diverse, densely packed part of Queens. It's got far less park space than almost every other city neighborhood. Alexandria's cousin Sarah is old enough to remember playing on this block before the closure.
It wasn't really much, and it was kind of hard because, like, with the cars passing by, I don't know, like, I was kind of scared because, let's say, a ball, like, flew over. No, I didn't want to be in the traffic.
When the city blocked off the street for the first time, Sarah says it was weird.
Because, like, we're not used to it, because I was so used to cars passing by.
It was a good kind of weird.
Yeah, it was a good kind of weird.
Locals don't think it's weird anymore. In fact, they want more of the street. They're fighting for it. Officials had promised to close the whole block eventually. Standing in their way now, of all things, is a car dealership at one end. They opened last year and want to keep cars flowing in and out of a service entrance. But locals refuse to back down.
We're not going to give up one single inch.
A group of activists first started working on closing the street more than a decade ago. And there was a lot of pushback.
There was fear that we were going to lose parking places. There was fear that we were going to cause traffic on adjacent streets. There was fear that there was going to be, all of a sudden, even though there's not really problems with gang activity in this park, that all of a sudden there's going to be, like, gang turf battles in this street.
That's Donovan Finn, an urban planning professor who was part of the push and lived in the neighborhood. Gatekeepers, as he calls them, city officials, community board members, thought he was nuts.
There's something about when you tell people you're going to close a piece of street, I think it just creates this, the situation in their mind where they just can't fathom it. It just seems so unlikely that you could just turn a street into a public space that they just can't imagine it.
The thing is, Donovan was waging a kind of insurgency in a war cars had won decades ago. It was a battle over who the streets were for, and about 100 years ago, it was life and death.
The automobiles were killing people at an incredible rate.
That's Peter Norton, a technology historian and author of Fighting Traffic, a book about how cars made their way into our cities in the first place.
And in cities, the people getting killed were overwhelmingly pedestrians. Many of them were children.
Back then, cars were seen as these pleasure machines reserved for the reckless and the ultra-rich. And people had different ideas about what a street was supposed to be in the 1910s. If you had taken a satellite photo of an older city back then, Peter says you would see a lot of the same grid patterns we see today. But at street level, it was a different world.
There were no lanes, no center lines, no line markings. People could stroll where they wanted. And I think it would have given you the impression of being something like a busy, small public park.
New York's Museum of Modern Art has black and white footage of Manhattan streets shot in 1911. The first thing you notice is everyone is wearing a fancy hat of some kind, even the kids. And the second thing, the streets are filled with people. There's the occasional streetcars or Model Ts, but no one looks out for them or even makes an effort to get out of their way. Probably because early traffic laws made cars super slow.
In the 8 or 10 mile an hour range, I mean, extremely slow by our standards.
If you can just outrun a car, you're not going to buy one. So a couple things started happening. First, car companies lobbied against laws restricting automobiles and for laws restricting pedestrians. We get jaywalking. Kansas City tried strict enforcement in 1912. people used to owning the streets were offended, angry.
There's one episode where women struck police officers with their parasols for being told not to walk in the street.
So Peter says officials added an element of public shaming. Here's how one Los Angeles official went about it.
He even recommended that if it was a woman jaywalker, that the police officer should pick her up and carry her back to the curb, because he said this would be so humiliating that it would prevent her from jaywalking ever again.
At the same time, electric streetcar networks were in decline as coal prices rose. It became cheaper to ride in a jitney, a low-cost, unofficial taxi. Think Uber before Uber. And cars got cheaper, too.
The private automobile, even though still relatively few people were driving their own car to work, it didn't take very many of such people to get in the way of the streetcars.
Public transit was getting stuck in traffic and becoming less convenient. In the 50s, lawmakers subsidized thousands of miles of highway.
The phase of the act is the interstate highway system, a 41,000-mile network of our most important roads.
It was tied to defense, the ability to move tanks quickly in case of invasion. But the final victory for cars, Peter says, was a psychological one that started with the kids. By the mid-20s, the top funder of public school safety education was the American Automobile Association, AAA.
They took over the safety patrols, guided the children to school, and helped them cross the street safely. And their message to children was, streets are for automobiles.
When these kids grew into adults, that was ingrained in them. They simply knew the streets were for cars. And the rest is history. Peter isn't a big fan of cars. I expected him to bike to the office. He works in this sprawling college town. But no, he backs out of his driveway in a four-wheel internal combustion automobile.
And I think that quite arguably makes me a total hypocrite. But my answer is that, like other people, I have to live in the world we've got.
Cars won. That's the world we live in. Peter says public investment in cars has come at the detriment of other ways to get around. Millions like him have no train they can walk to, no reliable bus. They can't pedal along a freeway from the suburbs. In big cities, public transit is often underfunded and struggling. But have cars won for good?
Somewhere around 2003, 2004, I began to notice that people were driving a little less in New York City. And soon I began to notice they were driving less in cities around the country.
That's Sam Schwartz, a.k.a. Gridlock Sam. He's the New York urban planner who coined the term gridlock. Driving had dipped before, during the Great Depression or wars, but always recovered and grew very quickly. Driving also decreased during the latest recession, which Sam says was expected. But then, after the recovery, when you'd expect rates to shoot right back up, they didn't. And that hadn't happened before.
Millennials were driving 20 to 25% fewer miles, not just 1 to 2%, which is when you see shifts, they're usually very gradual. This was a quantum jump.
Federal data shows rates continued to drop, except among the poorest millennials. Sam says that tells him younger Americans are rethinking their relationship with cars. Cars are not part of the American dream for them. And cities are thinking about reducing cars too, and not just the usual suspects, the New Yorks and Chicagos. Smaller cities are reaching out to him.
Fargo, North Dakota, Boise, Idaho, Des Moines, Iowa, Grand Rapids, Michigan.
They want to know how to get by with fewer cars. Sam knows a thing or two about that. In the 70s, he tried and almost succeeded in getting cars out of a huge chunk of Midtown Manhattan, some 60 blocks.
All cars were going to be banned from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
He got so far as stamping out the signs, but a new mayor scrapped it last minute. Hotel owners pushed back, and really, it was just too radical. Instead, only Madison Avenue closed, and only temporarily, starting on Earth Day.
And all the mad men and mad women of the early 1970s came out during lunchtime with sandwiches, picnics, bottles of wine, and enjoyed the fresh air on Madison Avenue that probably hadn't been seen in nearly a century.
The picnics came and went, but Sam says his ideas aren't so radical anymore. It's not a car ban, but in April, New York officials announced congestion pricing was coming to Manhattan.
New York City is set to become the very first city in the nation to levy a congestion tax on drivers.
You shoved this down my throat just like you shoved the bicycle lanes down my throat, and now you want me to pay for it.
Drivers would be charged roughly $10 for driving into the city, anywhere between 60th Street, where we are now, down to the tip of Manhattan.
The fees go to public transit. The idea is less car traffic in urban centers, and it's worked in Singapore and London. American cities are watching New York's experiment, and with good reason. In big downtowns, cars are slowing to a crawl. The average speed in Midtown Manhattan last year, 4.7 miles per hour. That's slower than your average jogger. Experts point to the influx of Lyfts and Ubers, more solo car trips. So Sam tells me we're at a crossroads. Younger generations aren't as in love with cars as their parents, and we can't pave our way out of congestion anymore.
Over 40, now almost 50 years, what we've seen is the failure of trying to build more roads. If we go to Houston, where they kept widening the Katy Freeway to the point where now it has 26 lanes and the traffic is worse. It didn't work.
It opened in 2008, and it's likely still the world's widest freeway. Traffic got better at first, but eventually slowed back down. If you build it, they will come and clog it right back up.
Do you get up in the morning and you're like, thank God, I get to go sit in my car for an hour in traffic?
That's Lynn Richards, president of the Congress for New Urbanism.
Nobody wants that as an outcome.
They're a collective of engineers, policy wonks, and scientists. They fret over what cars have done to our cities and, by extension, our health and environment. But they're not anti-car, exactly. They just oppose prioritizing them over other kinds of transport, putting highways before rail lines, parking over bike lanes.
I'm not asking you to give up your car. I have a car. I like my car. I drive my car. I also love the fact that I can get to work faster on my bike than any other mode of transportation. So we're talking about creating choices on how to get around.
She says public fear is the biggest obstacle to reclaiming streets from cars.
It's going to be like gang turf battles in this street.
Yeah. Lynn says one way around that, get tactical.
It's called tactical urbanism.
Start with small car-free spaces and make it temporary so no one freaks out.
If you wanted to narrow a street in a downtown area, instead of, oh my gosh, what happens to the parking, et cetera, you use hay bales and temporary seating and paint to transform the street.
78th Street in Queens, that actually started as a temporary thing too. Couple weekends in the summer, then the whole summer, then, hey, why not the whole year?
Very quickly, you know, kids are learning to ride bikes here. People were having birthday parties for their kids.
That's Donovan again, one of the activists behind the 78th Street closure.
People were having picnics on this asphalt. You know, it's not really that inviting, but people were doing it. Just because of the linear shape of it, people were setting up soccer goals at each end and having, having soccer games.
The most encouraging thing to him, the kids on 78th Street who have never thought of it as a street.
To them, this is just how it is and how it would always be.
These kids are growing up learning at least one street isn't for cars. It's for them.
That was Jad Slaman reporting.